Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you watched television anytime from the 1950s to the early 2000s, you most likely saw Barbara Walters. You certainly knew who she was, a groundbreaking TV journalist and the first woman to host a nightly network newscast. A woman noted for her interviews with politicians, celebrities, and others, and the creator of ABC's The View, which has outlived her. People know they've made it when they become the subject of impressionists like Gilda Radner, and her brutal Baba Wawa send-up on SNL was a good example of that, but Walters worked as though she hadn't made it, or that it could all disappear in a flash. Despite her success in forging a path for herself and the women who would follow her into the trenches of the TV news business, despite redefining that business while trampling over a misogynistic culture, she remained a ferocious competitor until the end. Her story is told in a new book, The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters. It is the work of USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page, who many WFAE and NPR listeners will remember as frequent guest host for Diane Rehm. And Susan Page joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program. Nice to see you.
Mike, it's such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
I was thinking as I was getting ready for this yesterday that our listeners know you very well, because particularly toward the end of Diane's tenure at NPR, she was relying more and more on guest hosts, particularly as she was making the rounds for her farewell tour. How's she doing? Do you know?
She's doing great. I saw her recently. She still does a podcast for WAMU, the base station for her famous show. I'm hoping to be on her podcast soon to talk about this.
Oh, great. You and Steve Roberts were the primary fill-in hosts for her. How did that come about from you? Because you're a print person, and so is he, pretty much. How did that come about for you?
I am a 100% print person, and when she asked, I'd been a guest on her Friday News Roundup. Do you remember the Friday News Roundup?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Which was a very tough show to do. It was a terrifying, actually, for me. All of us, I think, would study up before the show to make sure Diane didn't stump us with some hard question about the news of the week. Her regular guest host had been Susan King, who was a local TV figure, who had then gotten a job in the Carter administration, so no longer possible to fill in for Diane. So Diane asked me if I would like to give it a try, and I had to admit that it had never occurred to me that it was possible for me to do radio, to actually host a radio show. And I think in the early shows, I probably proved that to be true to listeners. But over time, with Diane's training, it became easier for me and a great privilege.
And I don't know how you had time to do that, because I'm sure your job at USA Today is a demanding one as the Washington Bureau Chief. And yet, in spite of that and doing radio for several years, you've written several books, 3 books in 5 years. When do you have the time?
You know, I'm at an age where I don't do anything I don't like to do. And I've discovered, it's sort of like discovering I could host a radio show. I have discovered, to my surprise, that I really like writing books. So that's the path I've been. I bet you don't do anything you don't want to do either. Is that right?
I'm getting better at saying no. It took a long time. That's another story. Your previous books were about women with an attachment to politics, Barbara Bush, Nancy Pelosi. This one is about a media celebrity and journalist, and not the first book to ever have been published about Barbara Walters either. She published her own memoir a couple of years ago. Why did you want to write about her?
You know, I didn't kind of set out to do a type of biography, but I've sort of ended up doing that. All 3 biographies that I've done are of women of the silent generation, women born at a time when there was no expectation they would do anything consequential that would affect the world, that their names would be remembered. And yet all of them did surprising and important things. So that was appealing to me. Women who had had an impact, I felt that all three of them had had an impact that wasn't fully acknowledged or understood. And I also thought none of them had a really good book written about them. And Barbara Walters' memoir, which was called Audition and came out in 2008, was a really interesting book. It was a bestseller. And it told some things that we didn't know about Barbara, but it also had some things that were not entirely true. And one of the fun things about doing this book was figuring out what was true, what was not, and why she sometimes didn't tell the truth.
Was she sugarcoating the pill? I mean, was she in a self-protective mode in that book from time to time? What was going on there?
Well, for one thing, she shaved 2 years off her age. She said she was born in 1931. She was actually born in 1929. For years, she shaved off one of her three marriages. She said she had been married twice. In fact, she had an early marriage, which she would conveniently forget, even though they were married for 3 years. And she would also downplay her ambition. And this was so interesting. It was even at the end of her life, when she had been such a success, an unprecedented success as a woman in broadcasting. And yet, she still felt compelled to act like she happened to be in the right place at the right time and good things happened to her. That is not the way it happened. She worked relentlessly to create the openings that she then took advantage of.
In the New York Times review of your book, it says that much of her story has been told before, but where even Walter's own autobiography was, quote, sassy, yours is sobering. Given those other books, including her own memoir, what did you hope to bring to the table that others had not, and do you think you succeeded?
I wanted, for one thing, to talk about her impact on broadcasting generally. We think of her as a groundbreaking woman, which is certainly true. She was also a groundbreaking broadcaster. She had an impact on what we see as journalism. She blurred the line between entertainment and news, for instance, something that everyone thinks was great, but she did it. She did it because she was interested in both entertainment and in journalism. And I wanted to give a sense of the price she paid in her personal life. And that was also, I think, one of the hard truths about Barbara Walters. Three failed marriages, a difficult relationship with her only child, and at the end, a lonely, sad end, I think a sobering end, an end where she was largely alone in her fabulous Fifth Avenue apartment, surrounded by people who were paid to be there.
You know, it's 2024. You turn on television news on almost any network and you have female anchors solo anchoring. You always have a female at the anchor desk with a man pretty much these days. And that's the norm. And we have such short memories in America that it's always been that way, hasn't it? Well, no, not at all. And it wasn't that long ago that it wasn't that way. I think she came along in what, 1974? Somewhere in that neighborhood on the Today Show. And it was highly unusual. It was an all-boys club. Why did she think she could break into that club? No one else had.
So Barbara just generally had the attitude that there were all these rules and they didn't apply to her. I called the book The Rule Breaker. She was kind of a rule ignore. She ignored the rules. Like, There was a general understanding that women couldn't be anchors because their voices weren't authoritative enough. And women couldn't do the most serious newsmaker interviews. Another one, women couldn't earn as much money as men did. Well, she blew that one out of the water when she got a $1 million contract at ABC. But it was never easy. And almost no one was welcoming her. Hugh Downs, the exception, among the men that she worked with who were actually eager to see her come along. You think about Frank McGee. You know, Frank McGee was the NBC Today host when Barbara had finally managed to get an on-the-air role. She wasn't co-host yet, but she was on the air. And he found her so annoying that he set a rule that the president of NBC News affirmed that Barbara Walters could not speak during an interview until he had asked the first three questions. Now, can you imagine silencing Barbara Walters next to you as you asked the first three questions? Would you have tried that, Mike? I doubt that it would have worked. And what Barbara did was take that that lemon and make lemonade. She started to set up her own interviews outside the studio so that she could ask the first question and the second question and all the questions. And with that, she created what became her real strength as a journalist, which was the big interview with the newsmaker who everybody wanted to talk to.
Oprah Winfrey, and you write about this, said that when she first got into television news, before she was the Oprah that we know today, she had Barbara Walters in her head every time she was on the air. And she was essentially imitating Barbara Walters because Barbara Walters was the only woman really on television. And Barbara had no role models of her own. You can't imitate David Brinkley or John Chancellor if you're a woman. And no one wanted her on the air. Why did ABC, the honchos at ABC and the honchos at NBC want her on the air? If the co-anchors didn't want her there, why did they think it would work?
She worked harder. She delivered more. She was completely relentless. I mean, this was her strength, but also their strength as a journalist, her weakness as a human being. She had no second gear. She charged into everything. She would not let them keep her off the air. And the reason ABC gave her that biggest prize of all in 1976, signing her up to be co-anchor of the evening news, then the pinnacle of broadcast journalism, it was because they had nothing to lose. They were the perennial number three network. They knew they'd get some attention if they put the first woman on as a co-anchor. They decided to give it a try. Now, it turned out to be a big failure. She and Harry Reasoner were like oil and water. You have never seen a more hostile workplace on the air than the one between Harry Reasoner and Barbara Walters during that 30-minute evening newscast. But it established her as a figure who could not be denied and set her on a course that made her one of the most consequential broadcasters in American history.
We have to remember that Frank McGee, people may not know who he is today, but back then, Frank McGee with NBC was a major name. Harry Reasoner came from CBS to anchor the ABC Evening News. He was a titan at the time in broadcasting. And for a guy who was so big, it's remarkable to me how insecure he was about this because at the end of the first broadcast, you write, he tall on the air, he tallied up the time that she had in the broadcast versus him and told her on the air, "You owe me 4 minutes."
So
It's astounding.
you watch this moment. I mean, they had known that he was going to say a few words at the end to welcome her, and he was a noted wordsmith. He did a column, print columns. He was known for being able to write. Here was the least friendly possible welcome you can imagine. "You owe me 4 minutes." You see her look a little confused and kind of chuckle, like, "Is he joking?" And then you see him glower at her. You know, that glower became such a standard thing with Harry Reasoner on the air that the director stopped doing what they call two shots, which is a camera angle where you like would see Harry Reasoner watching Barbara Walters as she talked. They had to stop doing that because he was always scowling at her.
Susan Page is our guest. She's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, but she's also written a book about Barbara Walters, whom we are talking about this morning. The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters. One of the reasons the men didn't like Barbara was because when she went to ABC, they gave her a lot of money. And we'll talk about that and many other things when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Her book is called The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters, who is a legend in broadcasting. but you would never have assumed that that could ever happen when she first set foot in the door at CBS, I think as a writer behind the scenes, and then moved to NBC, later to ABC. We were talking about her anchoring the evening news with Harry Reasoner, who left ABC to go back to CBS to do 60 Minutes, I guess in part because he couldn't stand anchoring with Barbara Walters. You write about Harry Reasoner, and you tell us things that I never knew, and I thought I knew a lot about these people. He was, you say, an admitted chauvinist who opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, endorsed the bride's vow to obey her husband, believing that those who did were happier. Now, I just want to point out, this is not 1876. This is 1976, and he didn't like sharing the anchor desk with anyone. Male or female. Did she know what she'd be facing? Did this come as a complete surprise to her at ABC, having been through what she did at NBC with Frank McGee?
You know, the first four words of this book are, she had been warned, period. And she had been warned. Howard K. Smith warned her. He had been the co-anchor with Harry Reasoner on the ABC Evening News, and Harry had gotten him pushed off to a commentator's role because Harry Reasoner wanted to be the sole anchor. Harry Reasoner's problem was his ratings weren't very good, and that weakened his position at ABC. When they were talking about hiring a Barbara Walters, he threatened, as a co-anchor, he threatened to quit. Now, he didn't quit. Instead, he got a big raise to get closer, although not equal to her $1 million salary. But he was definitely a hostile figure. He, you know, you mentioned the various sexist things he endorsed. He did this column. He regularly wrote columns with us, and they were written gracefully, but they do not stand the test of time. One of them, he opposed efforts by stewardesses to be taken more seriously in their job, saying their real role was to be soft and fluffy like clouds. And then when they were no longer, you know, soft and fluffy, they should go away and be replaced with new stewardesses. So you can imagine some of the things that Harry Reasoner said and thought and did would have gotten him fired today if he had done them.
Wow. It's pretty amazing. You mentioned the $1 million. Barbara Walters, we take for granted today that television news anchors make a lot of money. They didn't always. And she was the first person, not the first woman, the first person to make $1 million. That's what they offered her when she went to ABC. What was the impact of that?
That's what she demanded when she went to ABC.
Okay.
And they broke it up between the news division and the entertainment division. So the news division was on the hook for the whole $1 million. And she also did these four specials a year, which became also part of her signature. You know, her dad was an impresario. Her dad had been a vaudeville booker who then started nightclubs. He had an entertainment background. And, you know, one thing about entertainers is that they demand big salaries. If they're going to draw a lot of people into your concert hall or into your nightclub, they want a piece of the take. And that's the attitude that journalists had thought was quite unseemly, but it's the attitude that Barbara had. And she came in, and there was a lot of poo-pooing or alarm expressed when she did this, that somehow an important line had been crossed for journalists, but all the other journalists then charged over that line, Walter Cronkite among them, and got big raises because of the mark that Barbara Walters had set. Not that they ever thanked her for it.
People have to remember, this is the era that Walter Cronkite ruled in the evening news department. He was the most trusted man in America. And on the other side, at NBC, I think it was Chet Huntley and David Brinkley who co-anchored the news over there. They were all enormous people. They were not making $1 million. And she comes in and does that. There's an old adage, even though it's journalism, if you're on television and you're in a studio and there are lights shining brightly in your face and you are wearing makeup, you are in show business. And in fact, you write that Walter Cronkite said he had experienced a first wave of nausea, a sickening sensation that perhaps we were all going under, that all of our efforts to hold network television news aloof from show business had failed. How much of that was true concern about keeping the purity of journalism versus chauvinism versus prescience over what TV news has become?
I would say yes. I would say all those things. And it was, but there was an attitude by Walter Cronkite and others that Barbara was not a real journalist, that she brought these other things. She number one, she interviewed anybody who she thought was interesting. She interviewed actors and she interviewed despots and she interviewed notorious murderers. She would interview anybody she thought the audience was interested in. That, I think, was part of her father's legacy as well. And she would ask questions that I think ask questions of newsmakers that journalists like Cronkite thought were indiscreet. You know, she would ask the question that she thought people really wanted to have the answer. She would push for things that were more personal. She would push for making the newsmakers she interviewed more vulnerable, the listeners. That's something that's become, of course, very common. Walter Cronkite, Barbara Walters earned Walter Cronkite's respect, among other things, by scooping him by getting the first interview, first joint interview between the leaders of Israel and Egypt. But his respect was grudging to the end. And that was, there were several things that wounded Barbara Walters personally. And one of them was the attitude of people who are sometimes referred to as capital J journalists. And that would be journalists who see this not as a business or an industry, but as a priesthood. And for that group of journalists, Barbara Walters never made the grade.
You, I think you have said that she played a role. You owe her a debt of gratitude, I think were your words. And you're in print. You've been in print to be the bureau chief, Washington bureau chief at USA Today. You had to have been in print for a while, more than 2 or 3 years. Did you experience any of the same chauvinism or the same roadblocks that she overcame?
So I am 100% a print reporter, no question, proud of that, and proud of that. But you know, I number one, sure, yeah. When I was first applying to go to Washington to be a reporter in the, I was working for Newsday then, newspaper in New York. Applied to go to the Washington Bureau, and one editor said to me, "Quote, but we have a woman in Washington." As though you couldn't possibly want to have two women reporters in Washington. We already had one. So I think that these attitudes not entirely gone to this day, but my path was so much clearer than Barbara Walters' path was. You know, I think women in TV journalism owe Barbara a lot. Women in journalism owe Barbara for clearing a path, for showing that women could do big interviews and achieve. I actually think that in Barbara's time, when she was breaking these glass ceilings, girls generally owed her something because she was perhaps the most public figure demonstrating that the rules that were keeping women from doing big things in law and in medicine and the military and in sports, and that they didn't have to be that way, because here was a woman who stood up to everybody, who questioned the most powerful men in the world and who commanded their respect. So I think that she was, I think that there, this now there are a lot of women role models in all kinds of fields. But then there was Barbara Walters as the most public one saying, sure, women can do this, try it.
As you write about, and as we'll talk about later in this conversation, she was incredibly competitive. And you have to be to make it at that level and to sustain a career as long as she did at that level, because there's always somebody nipping at your heels and other body parts as you try to maintain your position in that world. You talk to a lot of people for this book, 150 people, I think, is the number of people you talk to. And I'm wondering if. Because she had a lot of people who worked closely with her, who thankfully were protective of her and continue to be protective of her. Who told you the most?
You know, if there were a couple people, there wasn't one source who told me everything, right? One reason you talk to a lot of people when you do a story of any sort, and maybe especially a biography, is you talk to people to gather string. And you make like a big ball of string, and then you try to figure out how it fits together. and tells you a broader story. But there were several people who were very important in helping me understand Barbara Walters. And I'll tell you, with all three of my books, I've adopted a strategy of doing interviews by date of birth. That is, I make a list of the people I really need to reach. I look up their dates of birth on Wikipedia, and I interview the oldest first.
Why? Because they won't be around much longer.
And three of the most crucial interviews I had about Barbara Walters. One was Bill Getty, her longtime producer. One was Dick Wald, who worked with her at NBC and ABC. And one was Ob Weston, who was also a critical figure with her at several points in her life. All three of them died within months of me interviewing them. Not because I had interviewed them, but because they were, of course, at that point, generally in their 90s. Bill Getty wasn't quite in his 90s. So the insights that these people gave me were just so valuable. And the fact that she had not died at the time I started the book. She died by the time I finished it. But the fact that she was at the end of their life, the fact that they were at the end of their lives, I think made them more willing to tell me what really happened. You know, there was one example. This was great. So you talked about how competitive she was. She was most competitive of all with Diane Sawyer. Diane Sawyer was her nemesis. And Diane Sawyer had been hired to ABC, much to Barbara's displeasure. She was starting a new show called Primetime. Her first show was going to be on the air the next day. Her lead guest had been brought to New York and put in a hotel. So this is Diane Sawyer's lead guest on her first show on ABC. And a producer for Barbara Walters shows up and tries to convince him to dump Diane Sawyer and be interviewed by Barbara Walters instead. It's unbelievable chutzpah. And at the time when this became discovered, Victor Neufeld, who was one of her producers, took the fall, said, Barbara knew nothing about this. This was my mistake. I'm so sorry, right? So I interviewed Victor Neufeld. And he says, oh, no, that was all Barbara's idea.
You spoke with Diane Sawyer for this book. Diane Sawyer, of course, hosted Good Morning America with Charlie Gibson for years and went on to do the World News Tonight broadcast on ABC every night before David Muir took over after she retired. What does she say about Barbara today? I know that she says that she never really understood why she kept trying so hard after she had succeeded so well. But what did she say about Barbara in retrospect?
I'm so grateful that she agreed to talk to me. And she described why Barbara saw her as such a competitor when she was hired, because they were both going to do big interviews. She talked about how surprised she was by some of the tactics that Barbara used against her, that she, even at when she had been at 60 Minutes, which believe me is a competitive place of its own, it went beyond even what she had experienced at 60 Minutes. She talked also about some of Barbara's vulnerabilities and how Barbara would be wistful with her, talking about the success of Diane's marriage to Mike Nichols, which ended only with his death, compared to Barbara's three failed marriages. So it's complicated, the relationship between them. But she also said, and just the point that you made, that she said she never understood why Barbara couldn't enjoy what she had achieved at the end of her life. And that is indeed one of the mysteries of Barbara Walters.
People who are not in network television and network television news do not really understand the cutthroat nature of that business and how you get there and how you stay there. And I had a friend who was a producer at 60 Minutes. And when Don Hewitt ran the program, he told me that you had to guard your back, not from Don Hewitt, but from the other producers. They would be in these story meetings and pitching their ideas, and the other producers would cut the legs out from under you if you didn't have all of your ducks in a row. So Diane Sawyer knew what she was coming from and what she was getting into. In the opening, I referenced Gilda Radner's impression of Barbara Walters. And the first time I saw it, I thought, that's hysterical. But then it kind of made me uncomfortable because it was based on Barbara's speech pattern.
Hello, I'm Baba Wawa. And welcome to Baba Wawa at Waj. We are indeed lucky to have as our guest tonight the greatly respected and world-renowned creator of shuttle diplomacy. Sometimes controversial, but to my mind, a really regular guy. Secretary of State, Dr. Henry Kissinger.
So, Radner and others, including Sherry O'Terry at Saturday Night Live, would go on to do that impression and others many times. Do we know if Barbara Walters found that demeaning or amusing, or it's publicity, so it's good. All publicity is good.
It hurt her feelings. We don't think of big figures as having feelings, but it, you know, this was in effect a speech defect that she had, a speech anomaly. She had gone to voice coaches early in her career trying to fix it, which hadn't worked. Now her daughter said, "Hey, you know, lighten up." But then Betty Davis, she was interviewing Betty Davis, and she referred to the fact that her feelings had kind of been hurt by this caricature of her. And Betty Davis said, "Oh, no, this is very important." And Betty Davis recalled that there was a phrase from a movie she had done that had become her signature, which was, "What a dump," right? How many times has Betty Davis been parodied with that phrase? And Betty Davis told her, "If you want to be a legend, you need to have something like that." And that made Barbara feel a little better, because Barbara definitely wanted to be a legend.
And that's another example of overcoming an adversity, because she did have this speech anomaly, as you point out. She had difficulty pronouncing words with R in them in certain positions in the word. And she was told at one point, you write, that because of her voice and because of that, she would never be on the air. Well, not only was she on the air, but she outlasted almost everybody on the air. How did that happen? I have 30 seconds. How did that happen?
Don Hewitt told her she could never be on the air. But it was like everything else. She wanted to be on the air, that she was more confident. She was more fully alive when she was in front of a camera with a red light on. She was going to do that, and nothing and no speech anomaly was going to stop her.
Susan Page is our guest. She's just written The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters. We have much more to talk about. We'll never get it all answered, but we'll try when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Susan Page is our guest. She has just released her book, The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters, a true broadcast legend. But you say, Susan, that Barbara Walters always second-guessed herself. She was not confident. She was competitive and tireless and worked harder than almost anybody. And we were talking about her colleague and competitor, Diane Sawyer, a moment ago. She told you that she couldn't figure it out, because there was nothing more that she could do to make us honor her more than we did. And you point out that Barbara Walters' own memoir was called Audition, because she always felt like she was auditioning to keep the job she had or for the next one she'd have to get. Did she suffer from imposter syndrome?
I didn't think of it that way, but sort of, you know, it's not exactly imposter syndrome, because she believed she deserved to be there, but she didn't believe she ever stood on solid ground. And this was also, I think, something, the legacy of her dad, who was would make $1 million, and they would move to a penthouse overlooking Central Park, and then he would gamble it all away and they'd be broke. And he'd make another $1 million and times would be good. And then he'd make a series of stupid investments in Broadway shows, and suddenly he was bankrupt. So in her growing up, this up and down, that gave her a sense that you could achieve everything and make a single misstep and it would just be gone. And that was what gripped her. And, you know, she was confident only when she was on the air. When she was not on the air, somebody would come up and say, "What kind of sandwich do you want for lunch?" And she would agonize over this decision. But when she was on the air, and interviewing Castro or Bashar al-Assad, she was the most competent person in the world. So you tell me what that reflects. Well,
I was going to ask you, because later in the book you talk about when she was beginning to fade just a little bit, but she was still on the air. Her producers would say, when that red light comes on the camera, we have every confidence that she'll be able to handle whatever comes her way, because that is her milieu. How do you explain that somebody can be have that lack of confidence, know that everything is tenuous, somebody could cut the thread in an instant and you'd be gone, but when the red light is on, it's their show, they're in command. How do you explain that?
I'm not sure I have an explanation, and I'm also not sure it's she's the only one who felt that way. The only performer, the only big achiever who had moments, nights of darkness after spending the day in the spotlight. She had this difficult childhood. Her mercurial father, she could not remember ever hugging her father. Can you imagine never being able to remember a time when you hugged your dad? She had a mother who was unhappy and distracted. She had a disabled older sister. Almost all of her mother's attention, she felt, was focused on her sister Jacqueline, as it had to be. Her sister had developmental disorders, never went to school for an extended period of time, never lived alone, never had a job. And it was a recipe for making Barbara's own achievement something she just had to do. She had to do it to support her family. She had to do it to prove it to herself. She had to do it because maybe that was the only way she was going to get the attention that she craved from her mom.
And because of that upbringing and her mother's attention being devoted to her developmentally disabled older sister, and her father's, lack of warmth, to put it nicely, and the ups and downs, she said she was never young. Did that inform her life, do you think?
Never young, never at ease. Didn't join the Girl Scouts because her sister couldn't. Didn't want to have birthday parties because her friends would come over and see her sister, who had this disabling stutter, who was clearly different from everyone else. She achieved in a workplace where there wasn't a lot of sisterhood. That was a time when women saw each other as a zero-sum game, that if she got the anchor job, no other woman was going to get it. No way two women were going to be anchors. It was it made it very hard to have friends. Sisterhood, or that sense of supporting one another, is now, I think, important in many workplaces, including the one I work in. There is a real sense at USA Today and in journalism in Washington, a real sense of women helping women, of mentoring younger women, of looking out for women when you can. There was none of that when she was rising, and she never felt the confidence that kind of thing makes you feel.
She became famous ultimately for these long form interviews that she did, that you've referenced already, with celebrities and politicians and world leaders, criminals and more. And some people viewed them as fluff pieces, and they would make fun of her for asking questions like, what kind of a tree would you be if you were a tree? I'm not sure that ever really happened. That might be apocryphal. I don't know. And she was also famous for making almost everybody she talked to cry at some point in the interview. But that's not fair. She asked really tough questions on many, many occasions, did she not?
Yeah, she did have some fluffy interviews when she was doing, 24-year-old actors. Sometimes those were a little fluffy. She did ask the tree question, to her forever dismay. Now, she would defend it by saying she was interviewing Katharine Hepburn, and Katharine Hepburn said that she thought of herself as a tree. And Barbara asked the follow-up question, what kind of tree would you be? She admitted afterwards it was a stupid thing to ask, and
I don't think so. I think that's a perfect follow-up. If you're talking to a famous movie star, and she said, if I could be anything, I'd be a tree, that's the question you'd ask, right?
Well, she regretted it because it became like Baba Wawa. It became one of the things that she was known for.
She interviewed at the height of the Clinton, I was, I guess what's the word I'm looking for? Well, forget Clinton. It's about Monica Lewinsky. She interviewed Monica Lewinsky, the White House intern with whom Bill Clinton had an inappropriate relationship. And you mentioned in the book the power dynamic between Monica Lewinsky and Barbara Walters, not Bill Clinton, Barbara Walters, because Barbara Walters was famous. She worked her way up. Lewinsky was famous not because she worked her way up, but because of something that happened in the Oval Office. And yet Barbara Walters subjected her, Monica Lewinsky, to really tough questions in front of an audience of 79 million people.
I wouldn't dream of asking Chelsea and Mrs. Clinton to forgive me, but I would ask them to know that I am very sorry for what happened and for what they've been through.
Do you take responsibility for what happened?
Not complete responsibility. It took me a while, actually, to come to a place where I could see what was my fault, what did I need to take responsibility for, and what were other people's faults and responsibilities.
The woman in the nation's spotlight is a product of Beverly Hills, affluence, and divorce. Monica's parents separated when she was 14 years old. She had a difficult relationship with her father, a doctor who treats cancer patients, but was very close to her mother.
So the idea that her interviews were fluff is just claptrap. It's just not true. And the fact that that interview aired with 79 million people watching. That's how big Barbara Walters was. That's how big television news was. That would never, ever happen today, would it?
The biggest audience for an interview on a single network in history. No show, no interview before it or after it has had a rating like that.
It's astounding. She started The View, the TV program that's still on the air on ABC every day, every morning, at the age of 67. That's an age when most people have already retired, and it's certainly an age when women had traditionally been told it's time for you to go do something else because you're too old to be on TV. And ABC, you write, did not believe in this program at first in The View. In fact, they put it on the first set. Was an old soap opera set because they didn't want to spend any money on it. Why was she so determined to do this and to go to battle with ABC to get this thing on the air in the first place? Why did it matter to her?
Well, it mattered to her because everything mattered to her. She was constantly trying to do new things that others hadn't done. She had this idea that is common now but had not been tried before of having women of different ages sitting around a table talking about all kinds of topics, including very personal ones. It gave her an extension on the air too. This prohibition against women aging on the air was maybe the final glass ceiling that she broke. She then appeared regularly on The View into her early 80s. Uh,
Yeah.
so, so it gave her more time to do what it was that she loved to do. It also, one of the things, Rune Arledge, who was a very important in her life, the head of ABC News, Rune Arledge told her not to do it because she would not. She had worked so hard to be taken seriously as a journalist. Now she wouldn't. This would imperil that. But she liked the idea that people would see these other sides of her. That she was all. She described herself as a pushy cookie, as the kind of the grand inquisitor of people in these interviews. And on The View, she had a chance to talk about her personal life, to look silly, to talk about sex. On Halloween, she would show up in these very elaborate costumes on The View. It was a chance for people to see the other sides of her. And actually, I think that's one reason she might have liked. She knew I was working on this book, although she wasn't well enough for me to interview her. And I think one of the things that perhaps she liked about the idea of someone doing a biography of her was to show her as a three-dimensional figure, not just as someone in two dimensions on a TV screen.
On the last episode of The View on which she appeared, every single female anchor, with the exception of one who they didn't invite because it was an oversight, appeared on that program. They came to say thank you. And it was thank you. It wasn't goodbye. It was thank you to her. It's a very touching moment. And I think one that she did not anticipate because they had hidden it from her. Do you know what kind of an impact it actually had on her to see all of these women from every network come to her program on her last day?
You know, I think it made, you can see on the show how surprised she is when Oprah Winfrey comes out, the first one to come out on the string of more than two dozen famous women broadcasters. These were women with whom she was friendly and women with whom she was not friendly, all of them paying tribute to her. She then said at the end of the show, this is my legacy. You know, that was a view that she didn't always embrace. You know, she was not breaking through barriers to help Diane Sawyer and Oprah Winfrey and Leslie Stahl succeed. She was breaking through barriers to let Barbara Walters succeed. And the fact that it had the effect of making an easier path for all these other women was something that sometimes she resented, that they didn't have to work as hard as she did. I think this was a reminder in real time to her that this is something that she did that was important and honorable and that she should be glad to embrace.
When she left, she just kind of disappeared from the scene. And you say that you were struck by the isolation and the loneliness that she endured in her final years. Talk about that.
So she had suffered a fall at the British Embassy in January 2013 that had continuing consequences over the years that followed. This was not something that was disclosed at the time. And she developed what's called encephalitis, or sometimes called water on the brain. And this is associated with some cognitive decline and also physical decline. And she was eventually using a wheelchair. And she did not want anyone to see her in this lesser state. She didn't want anyone to see her not at her peak moments. And so she began to refuse to even let very good friends come in and visit her. So she spent these final years in her apartment, this fabulous apartment, still on the market, by the way, on Fifth Avenue, view of Central Park. But she wouldn't go to the park because she was concerned that paparazzi would get a picture of her in her wheelchair. And this is a lonely end for a woman who reveled in being in the middle of everything, loved to be talking and questioning and in the news and talking to the most interesting people in the world. And yet she had this very silent and somber end.
And you quote an interview that she did with Oprah in which she spoke about looking back on her career and kind of marveled at her own accomplishments, thinking, did I do that? And she asks herself, why didn't I enjoy it more? I mean, why didn't she? What was the point?
You know, I asked more than 100 people who knew Barbara, was she happy? And the number who said she was happy, you could count them on one hand. People said she loved what she did. She was proud of what she did. She liked having money. She loved being famous. But happiness, that was something that she never had.
We only have a minute left, and I have so many questions. I think it was you that told Katie Couric, correct me if I'm wrong, that Barbara's is a cautionary tale for all of us how not to live. And yet on her gravestone, her tombstone, which you found because no one really knew where it was, it simply says, no regrets. I had a wonderful life.
And so that's how maybe we should think of her. No regrets. Not that there weren't things in her life that she might have done differently, perhaps, or could have done differently, maybe. But that she ended her life with no regrets and feeling that she'd done important things she wanted to do, and things that no woman had ever done before.
And even though it was not a conventional life, she was a resounding success. And isn't that enough?
We're still talking about her, Mike.
That's right. And you can read about her in Susan Page's new book, The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters. Susan Page, great to see you. Great to hear you again on our station. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.